Everyone. We're off to a bit slow start here, a few minutes late, but we'll get things going here. I'm excited to do this show. As we have mentioned here in the intro, you are listening to Red Eyes Radio, and my name is Henrik Almgren. I am the editor and the webmaster of the Red Eyes website, and I will be your host for the next hour. And I'm broadcasting live from the west coast of Sweden, and I want to thank everyone tuning in to bbsradio.com today. And we have a really good show for you today because we have a very interesting guest joining us. His name is Torbjörn Sassersson, and he's a fellow countryman to myself, and he is the editor of Soul Travel Magazine, an internet magazine dedicated to remote viewing, out-of-body experience, lucid dreaming, and much, much more. And he had featured some very interesting articles on his site the past few months, and I have been linking to a few of those myself. So I hope that many of you out there listening are familiar with his site. But if you aren't, simply head on over to check it out. It's soultravel.nu. That's soultravel, one word, .nu. Check it out, because it's a really interesting site, and there's a lot of good articles there. So, alright, let's bring on our guest. Hello, Torbjörn, and welcome to the program.
Hello, it's nice to be on your show.
I hope you can hear me well. Yeah, can you hear me fine?
Yeah, I can hear you very fine, yes. Yeah, thank you.
Great. Very nice of you to take the time to be here with us today. So, to start things off here, I don't know so very much about you, Torbjörn, and maybe it would be a good idea for those of us who aren't familiar with you or your site to start off and talk. Maybe we could talk a little bit about yourself and maybe some of your background and how you came to start the site, so to say.
Okay.
Where do we begin? Who is Torbjörn?
Okay, I'm living in Stockholm, Sweden, and I am running a web magazine just like you.
Yeah.
And you have told the listeners about the web magazine, and my interest is in the soul, what is popularly called the soul, and the ability. I'm very interested in the ability to spread the knowledge about the ability, the paranormal abilities that we all have when we are born as humans. And I think that it's important to spread some light on this, the individuals, what we can do with our inner powers in a positive sense. So my background, I have a bachelor degree, or I think it's called a bachelor degree in English, in natural science, and but I've been working most of my last 10 years in the media sector. So I'm quite acquainted with doing websites and working with communications.
Ah, interesting.
And so it was an easy thing for me to start this web magazine, Soul Travel Magazine, because I was already producing websites for companies and so on.
Okay.
So I don't know what you want to know about me more than that. I have... I've been practicing, it's on my website if you want to read about it, but I've been practicing like yoga and meditation since I was a teenager. And I guess that was the reason behind that I started to have these experiences myself, like out-of-body experiences and so on. So So it came naturally to me to also do something to communicate about these experiences, my experiences and other people's experiences.
All right. And how long have you been running the site now?
Well, the site has been running, or the web magazine has been running since December 2003.
All right.
And so it's and the knowledge about the site has spread pretty well in both in Sweden and abroad, and it's a little bit overwhelming because you know you have an expectancy on you to deliver good articles and so on, and I try to do that.
Yeah, you certainly have, I think, because as I said in the intro, there a lot of interesting articles I think you have produced and compiled, and you're doing a great job over there. So. Sure. I was thinking that we should focus a little bit more today on the aspect of remote viewing, because I know that you bring up many different things on your magazine. A few of those, of course, as we mentioned, lucid dreaming and out-of-body travel and soul evolution and many different spiritual topics. But I know... because we talked a little bit before this show over the phone, and we talked a little bit about your background as a remote viewer, and I thought that was really interesting to know that you are practicing remote viewer yourself, so to speak. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a good thought. The thing is that I'm disciplined in science, to some degree at least, I find it difficult to believe in something that I haven't experienced myself. So even though there are skeptics they think that I tend to believe in anything, but that's not true. I always test things out before I speak about them or write about them. So in my case, I started to have spontaneous out-of-body experiences in 2000, I became, of course, very interested in this subject, and I started to read books about it, and I also bought some, CD training exercises from the Monroe Institute in the United States, and I realized pretty fast that I could actually induce these experiences by myself with the help of a training program. So, but right. I can tell you maybe about my first out-of-body experience. It was quite profound to me. I was sitting at work. I was working on a web firm. It was called the Jefferson Communications, and I was sitting in a meeting room, and I had I was sort of passive in this meeting. I was a listener. I was not actively taking part in the discussions.
Okay.
So suddenly I felt this very strong energy in my heart area, and I thought that what the hell is that? And I leaned back a little, and I let this experience totally take over. And so that was happened. That happened then. And in the next moment, I closed my eyes, and in the next moment, I had been transported like 2 or 3 kilometers away, and I was suddenly hanging under the ceiling in a room. And there I could see on the bed in that room, I could see my ex-girlfriend. She was lying down, sleeping on her right side with the sun in her face.
Oh.
And I... You know, in that state, you act a little bit differently from when you are in the physical. So you're very, very much emotionally driven. So when I was hanging there in the air, I thought I would like to show her that I like her very much.
Yeah.
So I leaned down and I kissed her on the forehead. And then in the next moment, I was suddenly back in the meeting room, and the meeting was continuing. And I thought to myself, what was that?
Amazing.
So I was away like 5 or 6 seconds, I believe, and then I went back to my working place, and I was just sitting there, and then my ex-girlfriend called me up, and she was shaken, and she told me on the phone that I was just lying down in my bed resting, and then suddenly you appeared under the ceiling. and then you lean down and kiss me on the forehead.
There you go.
So, there you go. And so what do you do? She confirmed that my experience 100% before I told her anything about it. I mean, she called me, and she told me about the experience that I just had myself. So it's interesting to notice here that when somebody is having an out-of-body experience, one can be other people can see you as a ghost.
Did she describe, like, in what form you were? Did she say anything about your, you know, were you translucent, or did she tell you anything about that?
Well, she said that I was looking. I had a grayish shape, and I was, I guess, semi-transparent or something.
Yeah.
But she could, anyway, see that it was me hanging there in the air.
Yeah.
So it was it was definitely me hanging there.
Yeah.
I mean, she called me, and so I wasn't as clear as you are in the physical life. No.
Okay.
I think that's very uncommon. Maybe that happens too. I don't know. But I know some mediums in Sweden that had the same type of experience where they had scared other people, and they thought they were ghosts, and then they were actually having out of bodies.
Oh, really? Interesting. And this experience, this was after you had began reading and doing a few practicing this yourself,
I started to practice. So this kick-started my practice in, not in remote viewing though, but in out-of-body travel, and I used the Monroe Institute series to do that.
Okay, this is very interesting. If you don't mind me interrupting here, I just to ask you, how did you know what you were experiencing, so to speak? How did you know what kind of information you were heading for after this? Do you understand? You see what I mean?
Well, after this experience, I just wanted to have another experience of any kind. So I wasn't looking for any certain kind of information or any certain kind of experience. Besides, I wanted to be out of body, an out of body experience. But during this time, I was practicing OBEs. I was also reading books about remote viewing, of course.
Yeah.
And I maybe 6 months later, so I took my first course in remote viewing, and I thought I had nothing to lose. So I had the right kind of mind state, I think, when I went into this course, and I had some good results from the beginning. But I also realized that this is really difficult to learn and become really good. I mean, if you are a remote viewing consultant, you have to deliver results at any given time that you are tasked to do it. So it's to do it on purpose, so to speak, for a company or so, it's quite difficult. But to play around with it, it's good enough. It's fun enough to do that, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
So what happened next was that I felt that I had quite good control over the out-of-body experience. So it was during a time I was inducing these out-of-body experiences every night and every early morning. Then I actually called the TV company in Stockholm, and I told them that, why don't you do this on TV? Why don't you do a TV show about out-of-body experiences? And they told me, we are so happy you called us because we were just thinking about it. So it was a good synchronicity there. And they called me in, and I went to this meeting, and they said to me that we cannot do a program with you if you can't do it. So they tested me.
Okay.
And I told them how to do it, and they put a photograph in a room, in a closed, hidden room, and I tried from my home to go out of body into this room and to pinpoint the photograph. And I had 7 days to do it. So I was working from home. And on the fourth day, I delivered my first and only result, and it was a photograph I found on the internet that was almost 100% matching the photo inside the room.
Oh.
So they were quite shocked because they didn't thought it could be that good. And to be honest, I didn't think that either myself. I could pinpoint that the photo, but I did. And so they said, let's do it on television. So they reconstructed the whole experiment that was actually done in a scientific way. It wasn't double-blinded, mm-hmm. but it was single-blind, I think it's called.
Okay.
And the good thing is that, I mean, in Sweden, people are getting more and more interested in the paranormal, and you know, they're interested in the spirit world and so on. And there are last 5 years or so, there have been a lot of TV shows about this, and but most of these shows have been it's been very difficult for the viewers to decide whether it's true or not, because it hasn't been done in an experimental way. So this experiment with the outer body thing here was very good because it was done in a scientific way.
Yeah.
So that, I think a lot of people became, that wasn't sure about the paranormal, became convinced after this show.
And this when did this air, this program?
Oh, it was aired on TV4 Plus, it's called. I think it's a national TV channel in Sweden. It was aired in 2005, I think. Yes, 2005
okay.
in May.
Interesting.
Yes, so it's like a year ago, I think it was.
Yeah.
But, you know, the skeptics and the... Some professors, the skeptics, they were not happy about this project or this the results. They were very skeptical about that, and so they challenged me to do it again during a little bit more, even more scientific, during a more scientific situation.
Yeah.
So it was double blind, and in this case, I failed. I did not pinpoint the photographs. And in this case, there were two photographs in the same time. So I had to view two target photos in the same time. And actually, I called Joe McMonagle. If you know about him, Joe McMonagle is supposed to be one of the best, or maybe the best remote viewing viewer in the world. And I had dinner with him and a few other friends a year ago, and he said to me, you cannot do remote viewing on two target photos at the same time. So the second experiment was sort of failing from the start.
Yeah.
But I will not blame the experimenters, the skeptics about this, because it was actually my own decision to have two target photos. So I have to blame myself about that.
Yeah, I can imagine. You gotta be. What? How should I say? What parameters are involved in this? I mean, if you become like nervous, are you destined to fail then? Or how should your mood be, so to speak? Is there any rules here to make it work better?
Oh, that's a very good question, because I think. People that have paranormal skills, they should not work with skeptics at all, because you have to work in a positive environment where people are either neutral or about it or positive. Because I mean, paranormal events takes place on a subatomic level. It's on a subliminal, on a subatomic level, it seems. And this level is very easy to disturb, and you should, if you are negative, you tend, it seems like the researchers can actually affect the experiment in a negative way.
Of
it's course. Like when quantum physics speaks about experimentation, they say themselves that the experimenter is affecting the experiment. So I think we have, it's pretty clear that's the fact.
Exactly.
Yes, so we have to do it in a positive environment.
So so how then does one convince a skeptic? It's impossible, right?
a skeptic will never be convinced, because I think a skeptic have to have his or her own experience.
Yes.
And as long as they don't have that, his or her own experience, they will tend to stick to their own belief system. And the skeptic's belief system does not include the paranormal. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It includes the natural science, you know, the Newton science and so on, but
yeah,
not this stuff. So I tried, you know, I tried many times to convince skeptics, and I've been challenged by skeptics to do experiments, and I said yes, and I done them, and I had sometimes good results, and sometimes quite good results. But whatever results that are produced, they claim that they can find faults in it, even if they themselves control it. So if you deliver good results, they criticize the results, they chop it into pieces, and they discard one piece by piece. So it's
exactly. Yeah, that's a shame. But listen, let's not talk about the skeptics right in the moment, okay? Let's move on a little bit here. There's one question I would like to ask you, and I know that this may be very difficult to explain, but I'm curious about some of the... I know that there are a few different techniques involved in remote viewing, and maybe if you can just encapsulate a few of those for us, or describe how do you work when you do remote viewing.
Okay, I can speak about the techniques that I'm familiar of, the first the classical remote viewing technique is called controlled remote viewing. Actually, it was called coordinate remote viewing in the beginning, but then they changed the C into the meaning of control. So they say it's called controlled remote viewing, CRV. And then you have, in this case, you are sitting by a table, and you have a pencil and a paper, and you are given the coordinates, and it's not geographical coordinates we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So that's the only lead you have, and that's the coordinates, and they are designated to a certain target photo. If it's training, they are designated to a certain target photos. So it's like an address. And the remote viewer is sitting in his mode, and he tries to be calm, and he should sit in a room that is silent, and shouldn't have too much stuff in it that could disturb him or her. And then he picks. He's trying to what's called get in touch with the target, and to get in touch with the target is using the sense or the feeling. So the first thing he has to do is to feel the target. Most people think that when they do remote viewing, they will immediately have vision or see the target. That's not true.
Yeah.
The first step is to feel the target, and then the vision, the pictures will come smoothly after a while. So the remote viewer is sitting there, and he's picking the target. He's receiving bits and pieces of the targets, and then he just writes down the raw data. He's not doing any kind of interpretation whatsoever. And any clear picture, and if he gets a clear picture, he is immediately discarding this clear picture. It's called AOL, analytical overlay, and this is a tendency of the brain to produce ready-made pictures. You know, the brain wants to know what it is, and it starts to fantasize on a subliminal level, you could say.
Okay.
So you could say that the remote viewing target within the remote viewer is built like a puzzle. Eventually, if the remote viewer is very good at this, he will or she will, after a while, have maybe total target integration. And that means that the remote viewer can actually pan the target area, pan, zoom, and move around, and have like a real-time vision of it. That's very uncommon, but it happens sometimes.
All right.
So that's CRV, the control remote viewing. Then you have ERV, it's called extended remote viewing, and in this case the remote viewer is lying down, and he is in a deeply relaxed state. He moves into what's called the theta stage, brain stage, is to most people known as sleep. But in this case, remote viewer mustn't fall asleep, but he must still remain in the theta stage. The extended remote viewing is a little bit more complicated because it definitely needs a monitor, and that's not a person that is guiding the remote viewer and keeping the remote viewing within a very thin span where the remote viewer is remaining awake but still in this very deep state. So the monitor is guiding the remote viewing to and around and inside the targets. And in fact, this kind of remote viewing is very much like the outer body experience.
It sounds like it.
But it's not emotionally driven. An outer body experience is almost always emotionally driven, and it's spontaneous. In this case, the remote viewer is not emotionally driven. He is more like logically driven or guided by the monitor, because the monitors has clear in mind to keep the viewer alert. And if it's a consultant case, I mean, if it's a task to pinpoint a target or whatever it is, it's of course a customer in the other end that wants to have good results. And if the monitor shouldn't be there, it's very likely that the remote viewer would drift off and go to something that is more interesting to him or her.
Yes, I can imagine.
So the remote viewer is kept on a leash by the monitor.
Ah, okay.
And then there are other kinds of remote viewing too, like technical remote viewing, and I think that's Ed Dames, one of the remote viewers from the original Stargate project. He was the one that founded that kind of technique, and I think it's very much like control remote viewing. They use coordinates and so on.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, and then there are also other kinds of. I think his name is David Carr, C-A-R-R, and he's doing what he calls spiritual remote viewing and psychological remote viewing. So you can use remote viewing to pan or scan a person too. That's possible. And there are medical remote viewing and so on. So it's the remote viewing is really a field that is expanding, and it's becoming more and more varied in its use.
Yeah, and I guess we could say that we are tapping into the same information. We're just, as you say, using different techniques there to access it, basically.
I guess I'm not sure if all the remote viewers are happy about that, but I'd say that remote viewing is actually controlled clairvoyance.
Ah, yes.
Because it's the same thing to me. I reckon it's remote viewing is using the clairvoyant ability or clairaudient ability within us in a controlled way. So in other words, we are born with these abilities, but we are not born with the skills. So in order to become skillful, you have to practice every day for years. But you have fun from the start. I mean, you have results from the start, but to really master this ability and become skillful, you have to practice a lot.
And did you, when you began from the start there, did you have like a gift for it, does one need to have as you say, a gift to be able to do remote viewing, or can any one of us just start and begin practicing? How does it work?
Well, I rather not use the word gift, because it's I feel it's a little bit old-fashioned, you know. I rather use the word talent. Some people have more talent than others doing this. But if you don't have the really good talent, you can practice and you become talented anyway. So
yeah,
if you think it's fun, you will learn fast, and if you practice a lot, you will learn. Eventually, you will learn it.
Yeah.
So some people are born with a good talent in this. Yes. The gift, I think, if it's a gift, maybe there is one possibility here. If we believe, for a while here, let's say there is a spirit world.
Yeah.
There are spirits and there are entities. Maybe these entities and spirits could give the ability, the clairvoyant ability, as a gift to a living physical person.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not, exactly. That's an interesting take on it, actually. Well,
I can add something to that, and that is that... If you start to try to communicate with the spirits, they will recognize you. They will, if you try to reach them, they will answer. And if you ask about help in remote viewing, you will have help in remote viewing. That's what I feel about it.
Yeah.
Remote viewers are not really talking about this, but sometimes they may say something that that proves this, that there is at least an experience of being helped by somebody on the other side. Sorry.
And do you think that this is what do you think that it is? Is it people who crossed over, or is it other entities? What's your take on that?
I don't really know. I can only speak for myself here, and Not long ago, I was approached by a person, which I think was a human-like individual. It was a woman. She approached me when I was resting. I was not sleeping. I was just resting.
Yeah.
And she appeared in the same time as I started to have a very peculiar experience of an energy in the middle of the brain. I know that doctors and so on, they said that there is not any possibility to feel anything inside the brain, because the brain has not that kind of nerve cells. But anyway, I felt this peculiar thing inside of my head, and I think that these things have something to do with each other. I have actually asked for help and to have guidance and so on, and then these things start to happen. So I'm trying to research these things, so I don't have any final answers about this.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Let's see here. I have a lot of questions here, actually, and a lot of interesting things that I would like to talk about, but I don't think there's time. We have just about 20 minutes left here, but I would like to go into a few things here. We talked on the phone about earlier about the background of the remote viewing programs and how they got started, so to speak, and we talked a little bit about the spawning from Russian and U.S. military programs and projects. is there something is there something that you would like to bring up here? A few points maybe, or some of the more basic stuff.
Well, from what I know, the remote viewing was born in the United States in 1972, and it was after some time after the Americans and it was their intelligence services, they had realized that the Russians were already doing a lot of research on this remote viewing. So they started the project in 1972. It was held part of, and he was working later on with Russell Targ.
Yeah.
And the experiment was research. They started as a research project, and a few years later, in 1978, the actual Stargate project started. And this project was running from 1978 to 1995, and then it was terminated for different reasons. Mm. So it was the first remote viewer that they hired to train. He wasn't a remote viewer at that time. It was Joseph McMonagall that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And then they hired another 18, so they were in total, there were 19 remote viewers. And Ingo Swann was one of the, I think he was the main trainer. And he was a really tough trainer, because they had to be 80% correct in 80% of the targets. So before they had that, reached that level of skill, they could not become operational. So they were trained for like 2 or 3 years, I think, before they were put in an operational stage. So,
interesting.
And from there it just moved on, and the project was fancied by some of the people in the military, and it was hated by other people in the military.
Yeah.
But it was all the time from 1978 at least and forward, it was funded by the Congress in the United States. So it was actually, according to Russell Targ, it was one of the longest government-financed research projects in their history. One of the most
really?
Longest. So it was definitely delivering very... very good results, or else it would have been terminated like in the 1970s.
Yeah, exactly. And
I have to return to the skeptics. The skeptics say that if it was turned down, why it couldn't have been good. But the thing is that when it was a project, all projects have a time limit.
Yes.
All projects have a time limit. And so what happened in 1995 was that the skill and the technique was spread into different kinds of divisions. You know, it went into the Air Force, it went into the Navy, it went into other divisions, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it was assimilated and used. It didn't need a project anymore. It was enough developed in 1995.
Ah, I see. And these did it begin as a spying program, or?
It was definitely beginning as a spying program, and they used it for spying on the Russians during the Cold War, definitely.
Yeah.
And there are some good, very good examples of remote viewing where the remote viewing were the single source of information, because other sources of information couldn't deliver any good data. Like, you know, if there's something going on inside a building, the satellite, the spy in the sky couldn't look through the walls and the roof.
Yeah.
In this case, in these kind of cases, remote viewing was the only source that was reliable.
Hmm.
Okay. And of course, you don't know if it's the information is correct until you have a total feedback on it. But
yeah.
And sometimes it failed, and sometimes it did really good.
Hmm.
So, for instance, this is a classical experiment. Example. It was when Joseph McMonagall. He was the only source, or one of the few remote viewers, I think, that was looking inside a building in Russia. I think it was in Semipalatinsk, or by the coast up north. And he discovered a new type of submarine called the Typhoon class.
Hmm.
And when he delivered this information to his to the intelligence services, they thought that he was wrong, but he actually was right. A few weeks later or months later, it was proven that inside this very building they were building this huge Typhoon-class submarine. And he was also correct about the details about the construction and so on of this submarine.
So he when you do remote viewing, do you draw what you see on a paper, or how does it work?
Yeah, the remote viewer is definitely he's drawing, and he's writing down his emotional his experience of the target in different ways, the dimensions, the materials, the temperatures, details of different kinds. So there's a lot of drawing going on, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
But also in the end of the session, the remote viewer has to do some kind of interpretation and putting the pieces together and some of the pieces. So in the end, you try to draw a more complete picture of it.
Yes. Okay, I see.
Mm.
Yeah, and one just have to avoid interpreting it through the brain then, I guess, and just kind of compile it in a straight-on fashion, I guess.
Yes, and that's the difficult part with remote viewing, and it's very likely, or it's a temptation that you start to interpret it in the wrong way, too early, and you may be seduced by the fantasies that might appear, from the creative centers from the brain. But a skillful remote viewer has learned to do it properly, so it's not a problem. The beginner has have a problem with this, definitely.
Yeah, and I know that when we talked there, we talked about that many of those who are leading in remote viewing today, some of the old guys then, I guess, but. They all almost seem to have a past in the military, and I know that I at least expressed, I guess, a little bit of my concern that some of these guys actually might still be working within the military and have at least ties to them. What's your take on this?
Well, that's a good question also. My personal opinion is that, or thoughts about it, is that they probably are contacted every now and then for certain tasks. Why not? Since they probably, when they became recruited in the 70s, they probably signed papers not to tell certain things and maybe to always be available if they are called upon.
Yeah,
I would say that.
But
I don't know.
Me neither. But it's interesting, and I also, of course, got stuck on the name. You know, the Stargate project. That's a very that's a loaded name, I think. Do you have any idea where the name came from or why they chose that name?
I think. Do you know the movie Stargate?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, the movie Stargate is, you know, it's about researchers finding this physical Stargate artifact, and they can travel through time and space.
Yes.
And what I know, that movie is to some degree inspired by the Stargate project. And I think that the name Stargate came from the understanding that this ability, this skill, can be used for not only retrieving information on Earth, but from other places. The thing is, you know, remote viewing is basically you receive information from a certain place.
Yeah.
What about if you reverse the process and you start to use, if you use the same channel to and send information? In that case,
yeah,
what do you have? Well, you have communication. So, I don't think they were thinking about that in the beginning when they coined or got the name Stargate. But what they eventually understood was that remote viewing is the beginning of communication, of using these mind states for telepathy.
Interesting.
So a Stargate could be a two-way communication, you know, technology,
yeah,
or technique.
Absolutely. And I mean, this, of course, I remember reading Jim Morris's book, Alien Agenda. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah, I read it. I love that book.
Yeah, and I think it's towards the end there when he describes a program, I think, a remote viewing program, where he talks about remote viewing as being used to both contact aliens and UFOs, both off-planet and even on-planet.
Mm.
And it's that last passage, I think, in that book is really exciting when they go through this. And I mean, I'm tempted to ask you here, have you ever tried to do remote viewing on a UFO or anything like that?
I haven't, you know, if you can't, I can't do remote viewing knowing I'm doing remote viewing on a UFO, because then I will definitely tempt the creative part of my brain to produce any kinds of UFO results. So if I am to view a UFO, I mustn't know I'm viewing a UFO. So the way to do it is that, let's say if you work with friends that are doing remote viewing, you to 95% you do regular normal targets, and then every now and then you put in one of these extreme targets, and then you in this way you will know that you have good results that are trustworthy. So I did this once. You know, there is famous photo taken by it's a photo of what's supposed to be an ET standing on a hilltop in South America.
You got that article on your page, right?
I published that result from that viewing in the Soul Travel magazine, and this guy, he's supposed to be called Mardox. I think it was Mardox.
Yeah.
So I was very curious about this target, so I designated, you know, as you always do, I designated numeric coordinates to this target, and I gave only the coordinates to my remote viewing friend. And she did remote viewing, and she said that was one of the most amazing, exciting targets she ever did. And she could actually confirm from the beginning to the end the existence on this hilltop of a extraterrestrial. And what she saw was that this person seemed to come. Well, she didn't say it was extraterrestrial, but when you read it, you understand it. And she said that it seems like this guy was sort of placed on this hilltop from above, from something hovering in the sky. A UFO. So it's a quite beautiful example of doing remote viewing on an extreme target.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then if you talk about ETs, I had spontaneous experiences of out-of-body experiences of you know, encounters with ET-like beings.
Yeah.
And I think they're very exciting to have these experiences. I would like to have them more, but they tend to happen quite seldom.
Exactly.
I haven't done any remote. No one has tasked me to view UFOs or ETs so far. No.
Okay. We'll have to come back to that some other time then. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, we just got about 2 minutes left here, and there's a lot of things that we didn't get to here, but I would really like to inform the listeners out there about you got a new DVD coming out, right? With
This is a really beautiful DVD. It's an exclusive interview with Joseph McMonagall, and it's going to be released in the end of June. And I had the opportunity to interview him last year when he went to Stockholm. So it's a kind of dramatized interview with Joseph, and there will be information about this on my website from after the show. Immediately after the show, there will be a trailer on the website that you can watch.
Oh, really? Oh, there you hear. So head on over to soultravels.nu right after the show there. So. Listen, we just have half a minute left, so let's do this. I hope we can do another interview sometime, because this was fascinating, and we haven't gotten to half of the things that I would like to talk about. So I would like to thank you very much for coming on the show, Torbjörn.
Thank you very much yourself. It was really fun to talk to you.
Great. We'll do like this. We finish off the show right here over the phone, okay? So we'll talk soon again, okay?
Okay.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you go, everybody. That was Torbjörn Fasterholm and his really interesting interview about remote viewing. So head on over to soultravel.nu right after the show. We're flat out of time. My name is Henrik Palmgren. You have been listening to Red Ice Radio. And next week we will have Freeman on the show from the Freeman perspective. So join us next week. Have a nice week, I guess. So, bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.